in 10 years from now, will shops have screen printing presses?
10 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
I would say probably less than 20%.
Whoa. Right.
You heard it here.
We've got a couple sponsors that help put on the show every single week that you guys should also check out. First up, Supacolor. Supacolor is the world's best heat transfer made for screen printers by screen printers. They understand the pressures and expectations of a screen printing business, and that's why they pride themselves on being super fast and super easy. Printavo15, you guys know the code. Type it in. That gets you 15% off your first order. Greg, you want to talk about Mr. Multicraft Daddy?
Have you heard of Multicraft underscore Daddy? If you need ink supplies or a daddy, Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies for over 50 years has been providing you with top brands at competitive prices. Mention the Printavo podcast and receive an extra 10% off your first order. Dave and the team are giving away more than PMI tape. Every episode, they're going to be giving away like a whole bundle of things. And I think the value of that bundle is like $500 or $600. We're talking ink, emulsion, you name it. So go follow him, Multicraft underscore Daddy. He'll pick out a new winner each week. Thanks so much, Dave. We appreciate you.
Easyway, spending hours cleaning screens is a thing of the past with Easyway's screen printing and cleaning chemicals. Their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively, so you'll be spending less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, Easyway is a passionate company about, and they're all about empowering printers of all skill levels. They work with a ton of distributors, and they are just a great partner in your business to help you with how-tos, resources, and expert advice. Thanks, Easyway and Alex and the team. Graphics?
What's up, Nick Wood? If you're listening to this, I love you. Thank you for texting me after every episode and telling me it was the best one yet. If you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, you go to 1-900-HOTSTUFF.com. You hit up Nick Wood or Lucas, and they're going to set you up. GraphicSource offers industry-leading outsource options for your shop by truly becoming a part of your team. They plug and play with Printavo and other shop management softwares. And when it comes to SEPs, mockups, creative art, order management, embroidery digitizing, back office admin, and customer service, there's no better company in our industry to work with. As you all know, we use GraphicSource quite a bit. And with over 30 years in the game, they really know and understand shop needs and have a proven track record of success. If you're not using them, you just stop what you're doing, listen to this podcast, like, subscribe, and hit them up to start using them. Mention the Printavo pod, get 50% off your first vector, SEP, or embroidery order. You can use promo code PrintavoPod24. Thanks so much, GraphicSource.
All right, let's jump in. All right, Mark. So you, with us, have one of the top performing, I think the maybe top performing episode. By performing, I guess. That's not a
right
answer. Most viewed. I'm just talking about views. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that was around pricing. That was around rethinking about your pricing because you're probably doing it wrong. Now, you've also done a really good episode on packaging your shop to sell it. Mm-hmm. Kind of an uncomfortable topic. I think back then, this was maybe 4 or so years ago.
Yeah.
And
well, COVID, actually.
There's been a... Yes, yes. And it's been a lot more open, and I'm grateful for that. We, you know, Brett's had folks talk about it at Print Hustlers. Shops have actually gone through it and have openly talked about it, and it's not a defeating thing. I mean, no. There's been some very good outcomes for people. So, with that all said, I'm just curious as to what's getting you excited now. Like, is it that stuff? Is it new stuff?
I can tell you in the last 2 months, I've come across some perspectives of business that are the biggest thing that I've done in my whole career. And that says a lot because I've always been on the front end of technology and I've always been on the front end of, you know, thinking differently about what it is. And about 2 months ago, walking to work in the morning, I walk to work every day, a couple miles in the morning, which is my kind of thinking time. I was thinking about compounding and the concept of using less energy to get a greater result, right? So this is what I call the law of inverse effort. Grow your business twice as much with half the effort. Because all I hear is hustle, hustle, hustle. Everybody's busy being busy and they're frustrated because they are getting beat up on price. They're getting beat up with tire kickers and price shoppers. And, you know, they're just caught up in this chaotic mess. And so I was thinking, okay, how can we look at this differently and consider what we're doing differently? And that's when I had this brainstorm. And basically what I realized was that, you know, when we file our taxes, there's a line for earned income. And that's how every business owner, the vast majority, I would say 95%, you two are probably a little bit different in this because you're at a point in the growth of your business and your relationship with outside investors and the sale of the company and those kinds of things. You've had a little bit different exposure than the vast majority of small business owners. But this earned income is I've got to do something in order to get paid. And in order to get paid, you know, I've got to sell a job. I've got to price it to be competitive. I've got to, you know, win the work. And if I stop winning the work, the game stops. And the opposite side of the view is an investment perspective. And an investment perspective is where the asset earns the income. So this is called return on investment, right? So we hear ROI all the time, but we really don't know what that means. Well, what it means is if you have an asset, that asset should be earning income without your direct intervention. And if you look at all really smart investors, they spend their time thinking and finding investments that will generate income for them without actually, you know, digging a hole or printing a shirt or, you know, banging a nail kind of thing, right? And so as I was thinking about that, I thought, okay, if we look at our businesses as an asset, you know, and we want to compound, we want to create compounding where the effort continues to progress and get bigger over time. Who else does that? Well, an asset manager does that, or a financial planner does that. And what do? They manage an asset portfolio. And a portfolio asset is a group of assets, which are typically stocks, could be real estate, could be, you know, some kind, you know, some other type of investment vehicle that spins off positive cash flow. So far, so good, right? So when we look at the asset portfolio, what are they managing? They're managing assets. So they've got stocks. They might have Tesla. They might have Apple. They might have Google. They might have Anthropic. They might have, you know, all these different, in Warren Buffett's case, See's Candy or
GameStop.
Did you see that thing is going again?
Oh God. Anyways, yeah.
GameStop,
sorry.
Nerves. Well, how does that apply? So that makes total sense, right? I think everybody wants to be in a spot where they're not actively,
right,
you know, forcing the business forward. Reading. I'm 15 years late reading 4-Hour Workweek, but maybe I'll try to tie that. All right, go ahead.
The premise is work smarter, work less to make more, right? So this is the way an asset manager works or a financial planner works. And they manage their assets based on risk, growth, dividend, cash flow, all these different kinds of metrics that they use to determine whether this is going to be a good investment. How is it going to grow over time? So then I stepped back and said, holy criminy, this is exactly what we're doing. Our asset portfolio is our customer list, and our assets are our customers. So then I thought, you know, I've been involved with AI since 2016, way before any of the generative models, way before it became popular, and have been using it to identify hidden patterns within patterns. That's how I found the pricing strategy. I was using AI to find these patterns that were hidden within the matrix, right? The matrix, the pricing matrix of, for your price breaks. So I was already familiar with how to do that. The first part is identifying the pattern. The second part is predicting the outcome from those patterns. So if you look at this from pricing, it's like, okay, what happens at 72 pieces? What happens at 144? What happens at 553? What happens at 721? Not just the even numbers, 300, 150, whatever it is that we do, right? So now I can see where I was predicting the outcome moving forward. So what we did is I've got a really good data kid that works for me. I shouldn't say kid. He's your age. Both you guys, he's a little bit older than you maybe, but he's like a spreadsheet wizard, right? So we started analyzing and we said, okay, what do we want to do? We want to analyze customer behavior and we want to look at customer behavior and we want to see if we can find patterns within that behavior. And so what we did, the goal of this was to create a situation where we had 95% confidence that what we were seeing into the future was possible. Not 1 year, not 2 years, but up to 10 years in advance. And the way that we did this is I went to clients that are in my Catalyst program and I had them give us data over 10 years on their customer base. And we put that together into a giant spreadsheet that analyzed $150 million worth of revenue. And we could see how customers grow, how they fall off, what the attrition rate is, what the growth rate is year over year. So you literally have a crystal ball with 95% accuracy 10 years in advance.
Mark, you talked about intervention. Like, does the business spit off cash without intervention? And I think there's something very interesting there in a post-COVID, you know, like if we looked at the screen printing industry, maybe right before COVID to now, I feel like shops are adapting and changing their services. I don't want to say outside of apparel, but like t-shirts are just like one thing or screen printing is one thing. Can you talk a little bit more about what you see in the industry when it comes to what are ways that businesses are building products and services that don't require intervention? Because I think there's a lot of wisdom in this, like, is it annual recurring revenue? Is it, what do you mean by intervention?
So recurring revenue is the key factor here. We want recurring revenue that grows.
Okay.
Without us really getting into it. So what that means is if you look at your business and you're driving your business like you would drive a car, most screen printing shops are, they're driving the car. They don't know really where they're going. They're running errands around town. That's the best way I can describe it. They're running errands around town and they've got to do it tomorrow and they've got to do it next week, right? If they're progressive, they're providing financial information that's accurate by their bookkeeper and they're looking at their finances. I would say probably 75% don't understand how to look at financial information. Other than top line sales and maybe what's left. They don't really get it because they're afraid of numbers. And I understand that. I'm not making a judgment. That's just the way it is. But if they are, they're looking in the rear view mirror and they're evaluating where they've been yesterday, last week, last month, 6 months ago, sometimes a year ago, because that's the information. That's the most current information that they have. In the meantime, they're driving around town looking in the rear view mirror. Well, if you were driving a car that wasn't an autonomous car, right, you're going to end up in somebody's backseat or in a pole or off the road or in a ditch somewhere. And that's the way most businesses do. They end up surprising themselves where they end up crashing. What my goal is to provide a view into the future. And if you consider it as brake lights on the freeway, if you're driving on the freeway and you see brake lights way off in the distance, that's a cue for you to say, okay, something's going on. And as you get closer, you can see that those brake lights are blue and white lights. So there's something going on. It's either the cops pulled somebody over, there might be an accident, We don't know, but now our attention is really high and we're making secondary option choices. Do I get off? Do I take a different route? Do I go onto a frontage road? Do I slow down and hope for the best? Whatever it is. And if we look up and we see that there's a long string of brake lights that aren't moving, then we know that something's coming. And so with that perspective, I wanted to use math to create a view into the future with a 95% probability. And there's a lot of ways that we can do that. I don't want to scare people or say that you need to figure this stuff out, because you don't. That's what we do, is we figure this stuff out and come up with a strategy that says, okay, here's what you do. What markets are you selling into? I'm selling into schools. I'm selling into events. I'm selling band merch. I'm doing whatever. We can take a look at those events and we can see what the profile for that type of event or that type of market looks like over however many years that you want to look into the future.
Like the KPIs, like if there were like four or five figures that you are checking on your business every single day, and I have mine and I'm curious for you to critique them a little bit. What are the five or six numbers that you always want to look at every single morning? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I have thought about that. I want to know what we build yesterday, mm-hmm. You know, how much work we produced coming out of the shop. I want to know what my backlog is of booked work that is yet to be produced. And I want to see that for the next 5 days into the future. What's going on day one, what's going on day two, et cetera, right?
So backwards, Bill, okay, what did we do yesterday? Work in progress. So that's like, what's the next trailing, you know, not trailing, but the next 5 days of revenue.
Right.
And then what are the other key indicators that you're looking at every day?
Gross margin.
Okay.
But it's not gross margin per job. It's gross margin divided by the time to produce it. So if you've got a $1,000 job and it takes you 4 hours to produce that job, that margin, and the margin is the money that's available above the cost of the raw material. It's called contribution margin in the accounting world, right? And that contribution margin is what pays your total cost. So I don't get into indirect and direct and burden and all that kind of crap that the accountants get into. I just look at how much do I have to pay per month to crack the nut of everything. And I want to depress that closer to the beginning of the month. Because if I do that, then everything that I do after that point is 100% pure drop to the bottom line profit. So that's a whole nother conversation. And that's a whole nother podcast, which is super enlightening in terms of understanding what you do. So I'm looking at that margin divided by the time. And the higher the value of that number, that's the stuff that I'm going to produce first. So scheduling wise, if something is margin divided by dollar equals $250 an hour, and I've got another job where margin divided by time equals $500 an hour, I'm doing that job first because I'm covering more of my total cost faster when I do that. So this is one of the things that we can do to work smarter and have more money left over at the end of the month. Because if we just throw jobs in there anytime and we got a job that, and we see these small jobs that people do 12 pieces or, you know, DTF 20 pieces, right? And they put that job in there and their margin per hour or their, you know, the margin per hour is typically what we look at. That margin per hour might be $25 an hour. And their operating cost is $150 an hour, you've just lost $125 of value by doing that job. And what that does, that extends your break even to never. And so this is one of the reasons why companies are out of cash and out of time and out of money. They never get to that point because they don't understand the internal relationships of what they're actually doing.
Steven, right. How do you feel about that? Because so, I know you know a lot of shops, though, that will also take jobs to try to churn through and be able to break even and make payroll, and especially in slower times.
I think the number one thing you have to know is the cost it takes to open your doors every day and not print a single shirt. That's your overhead, right? And I think that's what Mark's alluding to is...
Let's go deeper on that. Because when you say the... Know what your cost is to operate. What does that mean?
Okay, so I'll give it to you in my perspective. The cost to operate my company
is the cost to keep everyone there for 40 hours a week. So all my payroll, my rent, my utilities, my expenses, my insurance. And we're not printing a single shirt. We're turning all the lights on and we're twiddling our thumbs. And that's what it costs to run our company.
It's right? It's the total cost.
Right. And so you start, I call that like Everest, right? And so you start with that number. Let's just say at Campus Inc., I don't know. It's $500,000 a year or a month. Sorry. If we bring in a $100 order and the cost of goods, the cost to produce it and get it out the door is $50, I have just put I've walked up Mount Everest 50 feet.
Right.
Or yeah, essentially, right? What I think you're saying, Mark, is if you take unprofitable work, you just make Everest a little taller and you don't make much progress on your little, on your hike, if you will. Right?
That's the key thing, is you don't make progress. You don't make progress on your journey. So you're only covering a tiny part. But the thing that's killer is you've consumed the time that can't be renewed. So you burned off the opportunity value of $1,000 an hour or $500 an hour. So as you look out over time and you start looking at the market segments that you're selling to and the size of the jobs that you're selling and the kinds of jobs that you're selling, you're starting to see that margin per hour, and you can start seeing which kinds of work are the best kinds of work for your shop. You know, I see a lot of stuff in the social, you know, the book of faces, you know, people going, oh my God, how are these guys selling, 100 shirts for $3.99? They can't possibly be making any money. They're making a ton of money because they've optimized the model based on the revenue and based on how they're going to produce that. They've taken all the friction out of it. And as a result of that, they've got multiple presses, right? So you're looking at it based on one press in your shop. You can't make it on one press in your shop. But if you've got six presses and you're in a low overhead market like Alabama, right? Or some area like that, and you're not in a major metropolitan city, you can absolutely make a boatload of money doing low margin work, high volume turnover. That's not my gig. I don't want to be that busy anymore. I've been there. I've done that. Don't like that, because you got, it's like feeding coal into a furnace. You got to keep shoveling in.
And that's the, you know, like everyone gives shit for Five Boys Apparel and Kyle Dennis. He's playing the LTV to CAC game and upsells.
That's exactly it. And but you're talking in terms of investment terms right there. When you talk LTV to CAC, you're talking long-term value divided by cost of acquisition. And that's a back end model, because now you've acquired that client. When's the next time you do business with that client? Is it one and done, or is it 6 months? Is it once a year? What's that recurring revenue potential? And what's your plan to maximize the value of that acquisition?
Right. And so companies that know their numbers, they know on average how many times their customers order per month, and they can actually apply a value to what that customer is worth to them. And because they know a value of what that customer is worth to them, they can figure out what they would pay to acquire that customer, right? And so
that's the front end part.
But lifetime value, can't lifetime value be longer? Or how do you look at that? As in, for example, software, you know, it could be 8 years, for example, is the average lifetime value times whatever revenue they're paying per year. Do you, I guess in the, you know, printing world, are you thinking about that as in when they trail off and haven't ordered within a year? And that's how you're trying to crunch those numbers?
So essentially what I look at it as, I look at it as attrition value. What's your loss or your customer churn going from year one to year two, year two to year three, year three to year four? You can calculate the attrition and you can offset that with the value of the growth from year one to year two to year three. And using things like the law of large numbers, the more samples that you have, the bigger your sample, the closer to the prediction you're going to get. And we use 95%. We want a 95% accuracy of what's going on. So that's why I say looking into the future of this. So there's lifetime value. If you've got a small shop, that lifetime value may be 3 years. If you've got a big shop, that lifetime value may be 30 years, right? But here's what's interesting is that based on 8,000 customers that we've done so far, 8,000 customer histories. The average lifetime value of a 1-year client is $1,595.
Okay, that's so that's good. I like how you time boxed it to a year, because that makes the calculation a lot easier.
That's exactly. Interesting.
That's exactly
close to. So we yours? Have an AOV of about $1,400 to $1,500, and if you order 1.5 times per year, yeah, we're about $2,000.
So what's your year two value?
I don't have that.
Nobody does. They're only looking at 1 year. They're looking at what's going on right now. They're looking at you know, they're looking at a snapshot in time. They're not looking at time, and they're not looking at it in aggregate over time.
And, yeah. And to clarify,
so you're
just to clarify these terms. So LTV, lifetime value, that would be if you bucket it into 1 year, it sounds like Steven's around 2,000, average is around 1,500. You can calculate that. And actually, if you want to make it really easy to calculate, you can upload the data to ChatGPT, tell it a little bit about the data, and ask it to calculate for a year, and it does it. But CAC, cost to acquire a customer. So this is, you know, if you take your marketing costs, your outreach costs, any folks that are kind of doing some front end sales work, and you divide it by the number of customers you purchased, that would be that cost to acquire a customer. All right, continue.
So that's the simple shot. That's where we started. And as we connect the dots and we move forward, we said, okay, let's go back to our customers and have them categorize the activity area. Were they events? Were they churches? Were they schools? Was it PTA? Was it band merch? And we categorized them, and then we did average value by product category. And that was all over the board. And so what's happening is when you look at the average customer value, you get this aggregate mix, this collected mix of stuff. It's useful, but it's not particularly accurate. And then what we said was, okay, let's look at the churn rate and the stability rate of growth. Schools are horrible. Unless you've got a contract, unless you've been doing business in an area for a number of years, it bounces all over the place. And the churn rate is up to 90%, which is means one and done. So this, anytime that you're doing bids, anytime you're doing RFPs, anytime you're working with volunteers that are not knowledgeable in the industry, the chance of churn is super high. And so essentially what happens is you have to repeat this process over and over, and you have to repeat the pain of tire kickers and price shoppers and what's your best price on this? And, you know, tell me how much it's going to cost for this. And we're just going for the lowest price. All that kind of stuff that we see in the comments, in social media of how do you deal with this? Where would your price be on this? Competitive comparison, horrible way of doing things. So my goal here is to try and add some clarity to the numbers so that business owners can make good decisions about who they're selling to and how they're selling, so that they can literally have more money with less effort.
But I think, Mark, you know, for the small shop, call it $500,000 to $2 million, right? They're local, they're in their community, they're dealing with the PTOs, the teams, all those things. Like, those are the jobs they sort of have to take to get to the next level of jobs. Because I'll tell you, like at Campus Inc., we don't market to our local community and PTO, period. We love, like, but 3-4 years ago, and we were putting on open houses and we were knocking on every PTO's door. And then we cracked into higher ed and internal consumption. We love that. And we'll take whatever comes our way, but we don't actively go get it. What do you tell a shop that's like, yeah, I don't like working with PTOs, I don't like working with teams, but that's where I'm at in my business? What advice do you have for them?
It's an evolutionary aspect of it. And so the concept that I focus on is this work, is this account profit capable? Is it capable of growing over time? And since they're driving their car on errands around town, and their primary nutrition is junk food, right? You're not gonna be a very healthy business if that's you're living in the moment and, you know, instant gratification kind of an approach. You need to be more intentional about what you're doing. And this is the classic reason I think that 50% of small businesses fail in their first years, because they get into business because they're good at art, or they're good at screen printing, or they're in a band and they can produce some shirts for the band, and they know other people in the music industry. So they've got one skill set, but they don't have a business skill set.
But you know what's tricky with that?
As they grow,
I don't think people mix it. If this is your first business, I don't think you necessarily know what's around the corner yet. And like I absolutely agree.
So you take
the jobs because it's like, yeah, I mean, this is great. You know, money's coming in, let's go. And so, but maybe the point is being a little bit aware of that sooner, right? So you're talking about contribution margin. You're talking about, do these jobs have more of a long-standing LTV aspect to them, of better returning quality, that they come back and buy more? Are we getting, you know, that $1,500, $2,000 minimum LTV on these types of customers? Is that where we're going? And maybe that awareness is the better aspect.
Just acknowledging it. Yeah.
Well, I think the factor here is that there's such a mentality today of side hustles and side gigs, and you know, they start something off and it turns out, oh my God, this could be a business. I could be my own boss doing this. I don't have to work for the man. I don't have to show up in a cubicle. Or if I do, this is my after work side hustle in my basement. I mean, I got started in a garage just like everybody else did with $200, but I realized right from the very beginning that this could be a business. So I went to school to get my degree and focus on all the things that I was going to need to grow a business. So when I graduated from college, very similar to Steven's situation, I was doing about $200,000 a year. I had employees working for me. I was running a full-time business while I was getting my degree. We went from 200,000 to 4.5 million in 18 months with no outside funding, no technology of any kind, no computers, no internet, no email, no nothing. But I made my growth from the get-go with national accounts. I called on Coca-Cola. I got orders from Miller Brewing. I went out and looked at people that could buy 5,000 to 25,000 shirts at a time. And then as I grew and demonstrated my capability, I had a portfolio of work that we did this for Hunt Food. We did this for Armor All. We did this for all these major brands. And that provided social proof and credibility that allowed us to take bigger and bigger orders. Pretty soon, our minimum order was like 10,000 pieces.
So, Mark, if you were to do that today, if Mark Coudray was graduating college today and he was going to try to bootstrap and do this,
and what would the business be? Mark's T-shirts.
Serious because you know, in the tech world, right? Like Bruce and I experience a lot of fast growth startups that can scale on Twitter and, you know, they play this game and whatever. What would you do today? Because I think, you know, the things that you did back then versus what actually has to happen today are probably a little bit different. And we can acknowledge
there's
that.
There's no question. The markets have evolved.
What would you have to do today to go from 200 grand to 4.5 million in 18 months without outside funding in 2024?
Well, first of all, I would have to have a product that had enough margin in order to be able to grow and do that. And I would look at a market that was going to consume the product and had a big distribution channel for that product. So if I produce 10,000 shirts or 100,000 shirts, how are they going to distribute that? How are they going to get it out into that market? So I would look at, if I was in a local business, I would look at businesses that are regional franchises. So in California, there's a regional pizza company called Me and Ed's. There's another one that's really famous, and my brother has a screen printing company, and for years he did the printing for them. It's a little hamburger company called In-N-Out. Well, he was doing a million shirts a year for In-N-Out. That's way different scale at this point. They've blown up since those years. But that was a regional franchise. So you start small in a regional area, and then you move out into the regional subsidiaries and you start providing them. So start thinking in terms of consumption. So in terms of Mark, consumption
who,
and
who are you going after? So I want to go get in and out. Who am I going after and how?
Their marketing team. Yeah. Who are they? Who are you specifically going to?
I would look at the local one first, and I would develop a relationship with the local manager, you know, the local manager, because they pay their local managers six figures plus to run an in and out because it's such a well-run organization. So I would develop a relationship at the local level. I would show up and develop that know, like, and trust connection. And then from that, I would say, okay, who is the next step up that I would need to talk to about, you know, becoming a provider for you? And I wouldn't look if they're already doing a major shirt program. You've got to displace the current provider. That's a problem. What I would say is, use that as an example to gain influence. So if you know that In-N-Out's doing shirts and they've got them for sale at every In-N-Out location, you would say, okay, how, you know, what's
else?
The problem with this vendor? You know, do you have, what's this like to sell and get intel from inside, not trying to sell them, but get the intel and use that to duplicate a smaller organization.
Right. Or try to find a different niche. Sometimes you have to find the what else or what could you do differently.
Sure.
Like maybe you have to talk to the In-N-Out manager and be like, hey, how cool would it be if we did a live print day here at the store and you let me bring a heat press and we did it for customers. You have to figure out what your hook is and you're in. And I think a lot of the jumps that we've made in business, our first NIL store was actually built for the student section.
Right.
And then it was an official online store that did things. And then we were able to add athletes. But if we didn't start with the student section first, we would have never gotten there. Right. And so you have to dig your teeth in and get kind of creative. Maybe they don't do shirts, or maybe they do shirts, they don't do hats, or maybe they don't do chef coats. Right. Like you have to figure out what your hook or your in is. And it's probably not going to be traditional. I think it's probably going to be pretty weird more often than not. Would you agree?
Yeah. And I think that the key thing here is that when you're just getting started, think of yourself as going through school. You start in first grade, in elementary school, kindergarten, whatever it is, and then you go to middle school, then you go to high school. You know, if you're the very best sixth grade basketball player, you're not going to want to do a pickup game with the local high school varsity team. And this is what I see people doing is they're playing small and they try and do a pickup game at a level that they're not capable of playing at yet. The sophistication level. If you think about how your business has grown over the time that we've known each other, you know, in the beginning, it was just another local college serving a local college market. And now you've grown way beyond that as you've gotten familiar with the business, as you see the opportunities, as you've start playing with bigger players that are thinking beyond just t-shirts, they're thinking business in general. You're expanding your skill set way beyond just doing the service that you're after. Every business, every thought, every market, you know, every political evolution, anything follows four stages: invention, extension, evolution, and demise. Invention is the idea. Extension are all the things that you need to support that idea. Evolution is the next variation or version of the basic idea or the basic invention, and demise is the end of life cycle. So right now, what I see with DTF and screen printing is I see evolution of the process of decorated apparel, and I see the demise of screen printing as we've traditionally known it. It'll still always be there, but we can go and we can look at what happened to the graphic screen printing business in posters and banners in the 80s, in the 2000s, when wide format came in. Same thing is happening in our industry now. Digital has entered our space and has brought the cost of the unit down and the cost of a unit of one down. And now that serves the smaller end and makes screen printing uneconomical. So
I wanted to tie this back into the growing business with less effort, because you mentioned two big things right already, right? So one, obviously picking jobs that have a better contribution margin that doesn't extend, I love the analogy, doesn't extend the time to get to Mount Everest. That's huge. And then two, really specific example of, you know, regional franchises, different types of customers that you can start to find these very high LTV types of businesses. Steven, orders. Steven, like, are there things as you've pivoted in these different roles as well? And then Mark would love your contribution here too, is of the growing the business now with less effort. And I think this is interesting because in your unique role, you know, you've been on the ground floor. Now you're running a larger organization. Can you contrast those two, right? Because not everyone's in this stage you're in now. More people are in the earlier stage. And what do you think? What are things to add in?
Well, Stephen said it early on the podcast today, and I characterize it like this. And what he said was most people are not thinking about selling their business. And we had a little bit of discussion, a couple of sentences around that. I always start with, what's your exit plan? What's your exit plan? If you're not thinking about end of life, is it handing off to your kids? Is it to run the business by itself without you being actively involved? Is it to grow by acquisition? Is it to grow it to a certain level and sell it to somebody? If that's the case, then let's create a plan for that outcome. You can change it along the way, but you're making your decisions based on, will it move me toward that outcome or will it move me away from that outcome? This keeps you from being stuck in the middle of, I don't know what I'm doing, or I need more sales, or I'm in that reactionary mode where I've just got to react to whatever our current circumstance is.
Yeah.
So for any business, I want to say, where do you want to be a year from now? Or here's a classic one. How old do you want to be when you're successful?
And what is successful? Well, what I think mean? That's interesting to define.
That's exactly the point of that question, is what is success for you?
And I think this is something that I've learned is, if you're ever playing the what if game, if I get to 10 million, then I'll do this. If I do this, then I'll be successful. If I this, then I'll be stable. That is just a myth, and you will never, never achieve that. Right.
That's only partially developed, connect the dot thinking.
Right.
If this, then this, if this, then that. Right. So if it's that, what does that mean? Why is that important to get to 10 million? Well, at 10 million, I'll be able to do this, this, and this, and this. Okay, well, why is that important? And when you follow that, that's called the Toyota 5 Why model. It's called root cause analysis, is to get to the real important root of what you're doing. Why am I doing this? If you're doing this to increase your income, you're going to be on the hamster wheel of life.
Right.
Your whole life.
Stephen, right? were there things that you did earlier in the shop that maybe you didn't necessarily know then? Because you probably didn't know, you know, what was going to become of Campus Inc. then. But were there things that you did that you felt had a bigger impact of growing the shop with less effort?
When I thought, so actually talking to Jed about this, I think I cared. Oof, this is interesting. I'll tell you what I did wrong.
All right.
Maybe. It is when I worked in, when I spent time in deep work, I describe as opportunities where you can really move the needle and work on big projects, mostly outbound projects, right? They took the least amount of time. Right, you would get in a room and work on it for a day and deploy it by Monday, but they would make the biggest impact in your business. And then you jump back in your business, and we joke about Hurricane Steven flying by the seat of my pants and going crazy on the production floor and, you know, doing all the things. And I was talking to Jed last week, and we were frustrated about a couple things in production. And I said, Jed, whether I'm there or not, it's the difference of them doing 80% work or 85% work. Because I'm not there, I am getting so much more shit done that is actually growing and propelling our business. So I'm like, I'm okay with B average. I'm okay with it not being perfect. I'm okay with them messing up and making their own mistakes and figuring it out. right? I've set the standards and it's up to them. When that light bulb switched for me is when our business really started to take off.
Huge lessons there.
Yeah.
That's a skill though.
You know, Jed kind of,
that's a hard skill.
But I was like,
it's an evolutionary skill though.
Right.
Because what you're describing, Stephen, is exactly what we talk about with margin divided by time. What's the value of your time? I look at my time as $1,000, $10,000, $100,000, and $1 million an hour time.
Right.
So this is $10,000 an hour time right now. Because I know that the value of this moving forward is going to be worth a minimum of $10,000. Now, will that be in a year? Will that be in a month? I don't know.
And you can't do deep work when you're sitting in your shop, like just dealing with the fires that happen. You have to insulate yourself. You have to be away. You have to be in an environment of people that can do deep work. But when, you know, when I walk into our production facility during the period of time that I'm there, there is not needle moving activities. I'm there to, you know, check in on people, talk through things, look at, you know, I don't say kiss babies, but yeah, just keep the peace, check in on everything. And then when I escape, that's when I can go really move the needle. And I think I tried to do both, and that causes an extreme amount of burnout, right? And so there has to be a little bit of sacrifice, and that's completely okay, I think. And that's where I think business owners, they'll be there for a decade and be like, they'll look up and say, what the heck happened in the last 10 years, right? I've been handcuffed to my business.
Well, so, what you're speaking to is the difference between a CEO and a COO. Sure. The CEO is the visionary that's thinking at a higher level, a 30,000 foot level. The COO is operational excellence. They're the ones that are optimizing the day-to-day operation of the facility, and they live for that role. They don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be visionary. I did a lot of R&D development over the years, a lot of the stuff that was really nobody was doing, and it was foundational 30 years, 40 years ago, that now it's just regular thinking about it. And I had a key person in my shop that when I did R&D, that was their hell day, because they didn't know how the outcome of the day was going to come out. Was it going to be successful? Were we going to get output out? But if they came in and said, we got to get 10,000 shirts out by 5 o'clock this afternoon, they were like, yeah, baby, let's do it. Because they could see what was going on. They were living in that operational mode.
So Mark, would you have called yourself in your prime more COO or CEO?
See, in my early days, I was definitely COO. Absolutely.
But you have to.
And it wasn't until...
I think it's the maybe the question is, where is the transition as well? All right, second question. Sorry. Well,
the transition for me was 1989. And 1989, we were doing 10,000 to 25,000 shirts a day. And for big clients like Apple Computer and, you know, all of these major consumer brands, Starkist Foods, all these different people. We had Disney, we had Nike, we had Adidas. In 1989, they signed NAFTA. And NAFTA, in 1 week, we lost Disney, Nike, and Adidas. And Champion approached me and said, hey, everybody's moving to Mexico. Can you help us redesign our factories to do what you do? And I said, I'm just a small guy. I've only got like 3 autos, and you guys have got like 60 in one factory. And they said, yeah, but you do so much more than what we do. What we want you to do is take what you do and just duplicate it across our facilities. And that was my first 7-figure consulting engagement. And I've had multiple 7-figure consulting engagements over the last 30 years with bigger companies.
But when was that transition of the COO to CEO? Was that when you lost the business?
Right then. So when they said, how much are you going to charge us for this? I said, holy criminy, I don't know. I figured out what I was going to charge if I was going to just do it as a consultant. And then I added 100% of my total cost for the entire period of the contract. Mm-hmm. And I said, they're never going to buy this. And they looked at it and said, that's it. Okay, we're done. So now my shop was 100% covered for everything for 21 months and my company could run. And to Steven's point where he said, Hurricane Steven, I was gone to the East Coast Hurricane for Mark. A week and I was back on the West Coast for a week. And they referred to the time that I was in the shop as the storm before the calm. And at the end of that period, at the end of that contract, we were much further ahead than when I was running the company. And I said, man, that was a shot to my ego. It's like, I need to get the hell out of the way and let the company run the company and do what I do.
Hurricane Couture.
That's funny. Hurricane Mark. Okay, Mark, I want to get you kind of, and we'll kind of wrap with this. I don't think we've talked DTF at length. Obviously, you commented a little bit on digital. If you were to look in a glass ball, what does Mark see in the future of DTF? Where's screen printing going to be 5 to 10 years from now? Should shops be buying machines, investing machines, transfer? Like, tell us your quick riff on it.
I think evolutionary wise, and I've got a deep, deep love for screen printing, a 50-year deep love for screen printing. As much as it pains me to say it, it's on the demise. It's on the demise. And because the cost of pre-press is always going to be there. The cost of setting the press up is always going to be there. We can look to other areas of the graphic arts, the offset litho area, the packaging area, flexography. All of these areas have gone digital. We are not different. Analog is going to be eaten by digital. 100% of the time that digital has entered a space, whether it's music, video, photography, printing, anything, it's overcome that space. It offers too much more. The digital economy, the analog economy is one to many. The digital economy is one to one. So the trend is moving towards a unit of one away from mass manufacturing. So what you're seeing on the higher end with the Polarises and the Cornettes and the Aeons and the Brother machines, they went from screen printing to screen printing plus digital hybrid. Now they're moving to pure digital. And the quality of the work that's coming off at the RIP level and with seven color gamut or expanded gamut, it's indistinguishable from screen printing. And I say that at a critical level. Now that's $600,000 to $1 million at that size. DTF is bridging between the middle of that. So what will happen is there'll be a mid-range that bridges between the high end and the low end. But even if you look at the very high end, it's still small orders that are run through a digital workflow with barcodes and individual configurations on the press and the dryer based on the barcode information. So it's managing the information in the workflow. So it's a few years away, but that's where it's going.
So screen printing in 10 years from now, will shops have screen printing presses?
10 years from now,
mm-hmm.
I would say probably less than 20%.
Whoa.
You heard it here.
So they're buying.
Look at what's happened in other.
Are they buying now? Or you say wait? Because like you said, Steven, a lot of people are on the fence, kind of waiting. You're holding them back. Steven Farrick's like, the 300 clip where he's like, hold. And then eventually letting them all go buy DTF machines.
Well, DTF is super popular right now. If you look at where they were in 2019, look at Print Hustlers in 2019 when I spoke there and talked about Einstein time and, the quartile analysis, which is another really great Printavo presentation that people should see, because that raises their level of awareness of who they should be doing business with. DTF was Supercolor.
It was just rum.
That's exactly where they were, right? And DTF, Supercolor is not inkjet, it's Indigo.
Right.
And Indigo is digital printing.
Right.
Right. So you can see where it's going. And it, like every aspect in the industry, if there, the suppliers, there was 80 DTF suppliers a year ago at Print United. And then there was less at ISS this year, and there'll be even less next year. There's a huge fallout going away. And the big players like Mamaki and Epson and Brother, they're entering into it, and they'll become the dominant player. And they're way bigger than M&R and Rock and all those guys. And if they're in that same space, Kornit's publicly traded. You know, there's a lot of dynamic going on right now. That market is unstable. Decorated apparel is not going to go away. It's going to be digitally applied, and the digital technologies with evolution of adhesives and transfer technology is going to fill the gap. My opinion.
Wild times. I appreciate your opinion, Mark, as always. I think it's pretty cool, as you've seen our businesses grow, to get your perspective on things. And so really, really grateful for your time today.
Awesome. It's always a pleasure to be here. There's so much going on in so many areas that we haven't even touched on yet, but they're all related. And in a dynamic market that's moving with AI, with generative AI, with predictive AI modeling, with pattern recognition, that's the next big thing. Is once we move past generative AI, which is like ChatGPT and Claude and all of these different kinds of things, we're going to get into the pattern recognition, neural networks, machine learning, and predictive outcomes. That's when life gets really interesting.
I think this was an awesome episode. You guys can reach out to Mark Kudre on LinkedIn. You'll find him kudre.com or catalystplan.com, which is where he works with, you know, tons and tons of print shops around the world to help button up their business and really implement these things that we talked about here. Printhusters, thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. We appreciate you guys. Thanks for joining on the journey with us every single week. We'll see you on the next episode. Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications, and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.